Hello, everyone. Welcome to See the Invisible, Living with an Invisible or Rare Disease. My name is Rhonda Jefferson, and I'll be your host today, but we also have a very special guest, Dr. Vegas Brown, an emergency room doctor in Brandon, Florida. He is affiliated with the Brandon Regional Hospital and received his medical degree from the University of South Florida, Mersani College of Medicine. We will be discussing today cavernous malformations. To use the Mayo Clinic as a source, they describe cavernous malformations or cerebral cavernous malformations as a group of tightly packed abnormal small blood vessels with thin walls. They may be present in the brain or spinal cord. The vessels contain slow moving blood that's usually clotted. And these malformations can have different impacts on people depending on the location and size of the malformation. Some patients or some with the illness don't even know it. They are asymptomatic, while others do experience symptoms to varying degrees. Dr. Brown not only has the medical background to understand and treat different illnesses or injuries, but he also has been diagnosed with CCM. So today we are going to discuss what cavernous malformations are, as well as really look at the disparities that have existed and continue to exist for Black people who are fighting this illness as well as other illnesses where they're not represented in testing or trials as they should be, because race and gender can play a part in how a person reacts to different medications or how even an illness may impact one person compared to another. Also, the testing, diagnosis, and treatment for Black people with cavernous malformations is different than many white people who have the same illness. So there are some initiatives or groups that are looking to address these disparities and make sure there are resources for Black people who have been diagnosed with cavernous malformations. I will include links to the Breaking Barriers Initiative, as well as for the Alliance to Cure Cavernous Malformations in the description of the episode. I'll also have a couple of other resources, such as HUDCO.com, whose goal is to create an inclusive healthcare system. I will also let you know that this is actually my second interview with Dr. Vegas Brown, as I originally did interview him, and as he was my first guest that I ever interviewed, I thought I had done everything correctly in recording the interview, as well as even had a backup, I thought, in case anything happened. But unfortunately, when I did go in to try to find the interview or link or anything that would take me to the discussion that we had, it was nowhere to be found. Even on my backup, I guess I must not have saved it correctly, thinking I already had another copy of the interview. But Dr. Brown was gracious enough to meet with me again, and I really appreciate his understanding. You know, he's very busy in his job, of course, in the ER, and he still, you know, took the time out to talk to me again, and, you know, again, was very gracious in doing so, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to him and learn more about this illness, as well as discuss the disparities that are still within our healthcare system. And you've probably, if you've heard my previous, some of my previous episodes, that's something that, you know, I'm very passionate about, because healthcare is not something that a person should have to fight for, nor is it something that a person should not feel supported in as they strive to understand their own health, as well as have equal and ready access to the best quality care possible. Having support in your healthcare journey and access to all the resources that you need should be a right that is available to everyone. So with that being said, let's begin the interview that I had with Dr. Vegas Brown. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Brown. Today, we're going to be discussing cavernous malformations and the initiatives that you're with to empower Black people in regards to their medical care, and especially as it refers to cavernous malformations, because there are huge disparities still, whether they're overt or implicit. So, you know, what can you tell us about first what cavernous malformations are, and then further about the initiatives on empowering Black people with their health care, and what are some of the things that we need to address? I know I just threw a lot of things at you at once, but I guess that's kind of the overview, you know, for the interview today, and, you know, just the importance of the equality that still needs to be achieved in healthcare.
Well, one, thank you, Rhonda, for having me. First, cavernous malformation is a rare disorder. It affects approximately 0.5% of the U.S. population. It is characterized by the formation of cluster of abnormal blood vessels in the brain or spinal cord. It typically occurs sporadically, meaning it can affect anyone, but can also be genetically inherited as well. The sporadic form is usually associated with one cluster of abnormal cells located in the body, whereas the genetic form or the inherited form is usually more associated with multiple clusters. Breaking Barriers Initiative is a section of Alliance to Cure, and they're basically working to, one, raise the awareness of cavernous malformation in the general public, in among health providers. They're working to address the disparity found in diagnosing and treating people diagnosed with that disorder. They're trying to work with different research committees and research bodies to find different treatment modalities to treat and lessen the morbidity and mortality from this disease process. They also reach out to the community and serve as a support group for those who are diagnosed with the disorder.
Okay. And support groups, I'm sure, have to be so encouraging for those who have this illness so that they have someone to reach out to. And I think something that's overlooked a lot of times with more rare illnesses or ones that you don't hear about every day. So, you know, to be able to go somewhere and speak with someone who knows what you're going through. Now, I know you mentioned that there's two kinds, whether it's the hereditary version or, you know, one where it's non-hereditary. Do you know, are there any like testing being done to see if they can determine why, especially those where it's not hereditary?
The Alliance to Cure, if you go to alliancetocure.org, there is research currently being done to look for genetic markers. There are a few out there that they have found, but they are exploring other genetic and biomarkers that can help identify people with the disease.
Okay. And that's an exciting time in science to be able to make those steps. Whereas probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it seemed almost like, you know, like we couldn't see that in the future. So to have that happening now, I think is pretty exciting to be able to try to address those concerns earlier so that someone doesn't have to wait months or years to get a diagnosis.
Yes, it's definitely a game changer, especially if you find out that you have the disease and if you're having a family member that is experiencing similar symptoms so that they can be identified and monitored and treated appropriately.
Now, I know that we had spoken previously, and you know, one of the things that came up as well is sometimes having a doctor that looks like them can be very supportive or can put someone more at ease, especially as in healthcare in the past, there's a long record of, you know, Black people, minorities not having that same support when they go for medical care. So can you explain a little bit about what you may observe and how, you know, you feel when you see that, if you see that, you know, someone is more comforted?
Well, yeah, you definitely see if a person looks like you, comes from the same environment as you, have the same sexual orientation or religion, you definitely feel that you form a bond. I have been told on plenty of occasions that when a patient comes in and they see me, a Black patient, and, you know, a Black patient with dreads, they are definitely more at ease, and they feel that I'm sitting down and listening to them and understanding what they are going through. So that does help a lot, making that connection.
Yeah. And, you know, I do have a friend who said that to me as well, which is, you know, one of the reasons, or one of the things I look at too when I'm doing research, is she told me that she had a white doctor for years and never understood how important it was to manage her disease because it was never expressed to her. But when she went to a doctor that was a Black woman, she felt so much more at ease. They had a conversation because she felt more comfortable. And I think those are things that some people may not think of. They may not even realize that it's a big factor when you're talking to someone about your medical care. You know, that's the most important and intimate thing you can talk about, really. And having that bond or feeling comfortable can open up a lot of doors. Because
definitely. I agree. You know, relationships are based on trust. And if you identify or feel that you can identify and trust the provider, it definitely makes the treatment process a lot easier.
Now, sometimes too, when, again, doing research, and I look at a lot of different things. So there's a few studies I've looked at, and I've seen studies where if you can see the same doctor time after time, that helps a patient as well. And that's not always open to everybody. It could be depending on your geography or, you know, how big your city is, how far you live from a doctor. So do you see those barriers as well sometimes within some patients that may have the cavernous malformations, you know, even especially if it's like a rare disease, being able to access treatment and access the same doctor all the time?
Definitely. Not only with rare disorders or cavernous malformations, but with many different disease processes. A lot of times if you are going to, you know, an emergency department or an urgent care or an office that has multiple providers, a lot of times the dots are not connected. The full picture is not developed. But if a patient has the ability to see the same provider, and they're able to monitor the patient, definitely it makes it easier to put everything together, the progression of symptoms, the different diagnostic studies that have been performed, prior studies that have been performed. So definitely seeing a, you know, a provider on a regular basis definitely makes that process a lot easier.
Yeah. And I think too, it helps with communication styles. You know, people have different communication styles. Some want to see things, some want to hear more about information, and having the same provider, they know what the person, you know, how they want to communicate and what they want to do as far as, you know, progressing in the visit. Now, unfortunately, we still see bias in healthcare, and some of it is like intrinsically into the system. It's not as overt or open. And some of those things have to deal with the past in terms of all of the baselines, all of a lot of the previous medications, all of those were developed on numbers or baselines from white male patients. So there's a vast amount of, or a vast number of people who've never been included in these tests or being included in baselines. So do you see now there's a more openness among doctors to look at differences such as one race or one gender may have a different baseline number for blood pressure or other types of tests?
Well, yes. So there are a couple of different things there. So one, there are biases, some, you know, outward, up front, some are implicit, and unknown or unconscious. So that's one thing. You definitely have a, when most baseline numbers come from in the US population, or most populations are based on, you know, white males, a lot of times females have been excluded or different races have been excluded for various reasons. So you do have that. You also have that they have always, well, not always been, there are some studies that have been done where race was considered, but considered inappropriately. Whereas the information was thought to be based, but it could be based on race, but it could be environmental. So you have a little bit of both things going on as well, where you have race not being included in numbers, or including race where it shouldn't be.
And I'm thinking maybe along those lines, say if, like, just thinking of where I live, there used to be like a large chemical plant. So if someone lives closer to certain types of production companies, chemical plants, they may be more at risk for certain things than someone who lives 20 miles to the west. So that's kind of what you're saying. It may not be included properly because there's different factors like that involved, depending on what type of illness or test.
Yes. So, you know, we spoke about it previously, like, you know, people with asthma, you know, they may say, well, you know, you have worse asthma because you're African-American. And that may be true, but it's because you're an African-American, or you are a person that lives inner city where the air is not as clean. And that's what affects your severity of your disease, not being, you know, quote unquote, Black or African-American. There's also been a recent study that came out, I think a few weeks ago, and it may have been published previously as well, that the uterine cancers that women are facing, especially African-American, their risk is higher because of the chemicals that they put in their hair. So it's not just the genetic mm-hmm. component, but potentially the chemicals that they are exposed to as well.
Okay, so that really shows the importance of getting down to the individual and asking not just broad general questions, but really getting to know what commonalities there are. And I mean, that's very interesting because, you know, I've not heard of that study, but that kind of expands the conversation too. You know, if it's regarding hair products, then, you know, for anybody, are there other environmental factors? I'm thinking of the baby powder, you know, issue as well, you know, the cancer that it caused with Johnson & Johnson, mm-hmm. you know, that there are other factors beyond that. And, you know, just looking at today, this is probably something 50, 60 years ago, some of these questions wouldn't have even been anywhere in the frame. They would have been like completely outside of the box.
I agree with you. Definitely there has been more of a open discussion about what affects patients, what roles systematic racism or systematic biases play, what roles, you know, the environment and health and diet choices play as well.
And, you know, I mentioned I had a conversation with another doctor a few days ago. And I know what we discussed previously as well, just the disparities in numbers. And I'm seeing it kind of across the board in a number of different diseases, that when you look at the morbidity or the seriousness of an illness, when you compare numbers, say, from Black women to white women or white men, the difference is, like, I would say, just horrendous. So the asthma, it was 5 times more likely for a Black woman to die than a white woman. And with sarcoidosis, I believe it was 12 times. And, you know, those numbers aren't acceptable at all. So looking at the past, and, you know, we know there's been systematic issues, there's been unethical things done in the past. Do you see that as the doctors are getting younger, meaning, you know, some of the people who've held those biases previously and worked in the medical field are kind of retiring? You know, do you see that that's probably an overall feeling, that the younger the doctors are getting, they're more open and they're aware, which is probably the biggest thing, of past issues and past, I want to say, unethical treatment is probably the best word I can think of.
So I definitely think there has been an improvement in recognizing the biases that medical providers may have held in the past. That particular aspect of medicine is being addressed basically from the start in most medical schools, identifying those differences, identifying and confronting implicit biases, identifying biases based on socioeconomic, you know, points as well. So I definitely think that it's improving. Even you have training sessions or simulations in a residency program where the finances or the race or the travel arrangements are included in that training. So you learn how to deal with those when you are a provider on your own. So there's an improvement. There's an effort ongoing through the medical community to continue that process of improvement.
Something that I think we've learned about just with the past couple of years, and that there have been great improvements on, you know, like right now, you and I are talking, you know, in two different states. And as far as accessibility to healthcare, do you think as far as travel and things like that, if someone needs to get to an appointment, the accessibility of, say, having a video appointment, and you mentioned socioeconomic groups, so making sure that that's accessible as well, if someone, you know, needs to see a specialist, trying to make sure they have all resources at hand.
So, yeah, I think telemedicine has definitely improved or will improve access to care. And, you know, telemedicine is not appropriate for all disease processes or all diseases. Sometimes you need to be, you know, the medical provider needs to see you, touch you, smell you, you know, hear your actual voice. But it definitely allows for the initiation of the evaluation. So it has improved, or it is improving with the invention of, you know, the formation of telemedicine. What was the second part of your question you asked about travel?
Well, just kind of in general, the accessibility, what was kind of made aware, I think, to a lot of people when the pandemic started was not everybody has equal access to internet, smartphones. It's not something that, okay, well, everybody just has that. There had to be rollouts to make sure students had accessibility. So do you see more recognition of that, that not everybody has the same access to even just looking up information online as some others may have?
I think it is recognized, but I think more can be done to provide access. I don't know if that is, you know, should that come from a federal level, from a state level, or if that should just be provided by the institutions, i.e. a hospital or a doctor's office. But it definitely that it needs to be improved where there is a place or a mechanism in place that people can get access that way.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say during the whole remote learning and things, at least where I live, they were very proactive and they had the resources to help. But I also live in a smaller community, so I can just imagine, say, in larger communities, the approach is probably different. So it's even recognizing the difference that needs to happen in the approach of rolling something like that out. I just hope that someday soon, really soon, that everybody can have access to a tool that is needed in so many different things right now, not even just talking about healthcare. Now, you know, again, we discussed previously, and you kind of touched on it a little bit about, you know, working with someone with finances and things like that, but having that support for people, because not everybody is, I would say, maybe as understanding of the finances, understanding how insurance works, and, you know, even having a nurse on support, like a support staff for individuals, because you know, different insurance plans have so many differences that, you know, I know myself until I started working or dealing with my own insurance, I had no idea that so many different types of insurance existed and what they covered. So I think you mentioned your hospital had like some type of support program for, you know, to help people understand the insurance process and give them support and a nurse and things like that.
So, yeah, well, we don't necessarily have a program, but we have case managers that are in the emergency department and that are on the floor that help navigate many aspects, you know, insurance, transportation. So they try to put a plan together while in the emergency or while in the hospital that once the patient leaves, that they can be successful, what the follow-up plan is, who they will follow up with. They will help them in many cases get on Medicaid or Medicare or at least assist with that process to get it initiated.
That's great because it can be overwhelming, especially when you're dealing with an illness to begin with, to have all of these other things that you have to think about doing. It can be completely overwhelming. So that sounds great. And I think that needs to be expanded and improved upon in a lot of places as well.
I would say when I was diagnosed with cavernous malformation and starting receiving bills, it was definitely a question for me. Well, how am I going to pay for all of this? You know, mm-hmm. I even as a medical provider, I had a lot of questions I had no understanding of the complexities that are involved with insurance and, you know, providers being reimbursed and getting studies approved based on, you know, the type of insurance that you have. So I learned a lot being a patient, more so about insurance than I did going through medical school.
Yeah. I mean, I know the same thing when I was in the hospital. I just kept telling a nurse, how am I going to pay for this? Can I go home? You know, and I was nowhere near ready to go home. I just kept asking that because I just knew I was going to be getting these tons of bills. But that's interesting too, because I know that with a lot of the doctors I see, I'll ask something. They're like, oh, well, that's insurance. I don't know. But they could be ordering something that costs, you know, hundreds or even thousands of dollars. How am I going to pay for that? So, you know, I think now though, too, in just those years, I have seen doctors, I guess, come to realize there are different types of insurance and asking more questions so that you're not getting charged for a dozen more tests when you don't need them.
Yeah, it's a hard line to balance. Like for myself, I try to treat everybody equally and don't want, or at least I don't want a patient to feel that the reason that they are not getting a test or the reason they're not being admitted or the reason, you know, a medication was not prescribed was because I believe that they cannot afford it. So typically I will tell a patient that, hey, this is what I think should happen. And if they tell me they don't have insurance, and I'll say, hey, well, this medication is going to cost XYZ. I will prescribe it for you, but here is an alternative medication as well that is a lot cheaper. It is for lack of a better term, a second class medication, but it's better than nothing. So, you know, I personally don't want a patient, I want to offer them the best, and sometimes the best is, you know, not affordable. So I give them an alternative so that they have something, or at least try to work with, again, the case manager to see if there is a plan out there that can assist them so that they can get the medication that I want them to have or the diagnostic studies. And in the emergency department, we order things emergently and we don't take finances into account. We try not to anyway. We typically order the test that is necessary. And from our perspective, we want to save your life. We want to give you the best treatment possible, and we'll deal with the finances later. And I know a lot of patients that say, hey, you know what? I don't want this test. I don't want to be admitted because I can't afford it. And it's very unfortunate that a lot of people have to make those decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people, you know, myself included, healthcare should be a given. There shouldn't have to be those questions. Probably 70 podcasts right there to cover all of those topics. But it is, we're in 2022 and to still have some of these
obstacles to face to make sure everybody has the best healthcare that they need is a shame that it's still happening and things still need to be addressed like this.
I agree with you. I definitely wish that finances wasn't a big factor in the treatment that people receive. I wish a lot of patients didn't have to consider it, you know, whether or not they're going to pay for their meds or they are going to eat or be able to drive to work or provide, you know, a, you know, activity for their kids. And a lot of times that, you know, patients have to make or people have to make those decisions.
Well, I think that strives and steps are being taken, hopefully at a faster pace than ever before, you know, with accessibility to instant information and people being able to communicate in, you know, different parts of the world, even immediately as compared to 50, 60 years ago. That's where I think that all of, say, the things that need to be addressed, they are becoming more and more into the forefront, whereas before those concerns were kind of isolated. Now we know about them. And so thankfully, at least steps are being taken, but there's just so, so far to go. And I know you mentioned socioeconomic class as well, sometimes being a factor. And that's what I think sometimes people perceive. You know, whether it's a provider or not, there's biases I've seen in the perceived socioeconomic groups. So hopefully one day it'll just be somebody walks into a provider and they get the best treatment. No questions about anything. Just they get the best treatment available. Now, are there resources or websites that are out there to try to kind of provide information about cavernous malformations as well as other resources for cavernous malformations, as well as a website for the breaking barriers? I know that I've seen them and I'll make sure I include them, you know, in the description of the episode, but can you tell us maybe a little bit about those sites or, you know, how they may be able to help someone who's going through this?
So yes, so one, there is alliancetocure.org. That is the primary resource center that I use that I use to find out about the disease process and the research opportunities and treatment opportunities available. I also use blackccm.org as well, and that's the Breaking Barriers Initiative website. You can also find the link on alliancetocure.org. There are other websites such as the National Organization of Rare Disease website. You can go there to find out about cavernous malformation and the other rare disorders that are out there. And there are a couple of different websites out there to help, you know, minority or Black patients find out about different processes that affect the African-American community. BlackDoctor.org is one of them. HUD is another one. Those websites are available to help get information.
Are there any other hurdles as far as treatments go that you can think of or want to address?
So, you know, for cavernous malformation, currently, you know, the treatment is basically a wait and see approach in asymptomatic patients. So a lot of times if the patient is asymptomatic, nothing is done. If it's in a place where the primary treatment currently is surgery. So if the benefit outweighs the risk, surgery is intervened or surgery is done prior to a patient becomes symptomatic, or if they become symptomatic, it is subsequently done. There is research being done looking at various medications to reduce the bleeding risk and reduce the size of the cavernous malformation. Typically, the symptoms that a patient may experience from cavernous malformation is based on the size and the location of the cavernoma. Some patients may experience seizures, some may experience headaches, some may experience weakness in their extremities. If they're having, you know, spinal lesions, those, you know, weakness can be very debilitating. If it's in the brain, it can also be debilitating. They may also experience, urinary or fecal incontinence based on the location where in the spinal cord that they are having their lesion. So the research is currently being done to see if there is a way to reduce the episodes, the amount of bleeding in the episodes of bleeding.
Okay. That's great because, yeah, I mean, just being in pretty much the center of, you know, everything that we do that controls everything that happens, that's really personalized. And that's where having the same doctor and knowing your patient comes in handy as well, because each person can have different symptoms.
That's correct. And a lot of times those symptoms are not recognized, you know, or the whole picture is not put together. You know, they say that the majority of people with cavernous malformation do not know that they have it. Again, most people are asymptomatic. Typically, the cavernoma is an incidental finding where a study is done for other reasons. And the cavernoma is found to do a CAT scan of the back because of back pain for other reasons, because they have a slipped disc or they have a herniated disc. And when they perform the MRI for the herniated disc, they find that there's a cavernoma as well. And a lot of times, if you're not seeing a provider, that study may not be performed or if you're not seeing the same provider, that study may not be performed because they don't know the severity or the progression of the disease process.
Right. Provide about the initiative.
I want to make sure that your listeners know that if you are having symptoms that are concerning, that you express to your provider, to your doctor, what your concern is. Advocate for yourself. If you feel that they are not hearing you, ask for a second opinion, ask for a provider, or ask for a referral to a specialist. But definitely one, be open about what your concern is and express that concern. Advocate for yourself and get the diagnostic studies and the treatment that you deserve.
Yeah, advocacy. You are your own best advocate. You know exactly how you're feeling. So I know sometimes it might be hard, but speak up. Now, I actually found that, and I saw this before, which never, I never brought it up then. Florence Griffith Joyner is probably one of the more famous persons who had cavernous malformations. And she was kind of, I mean, she was, in my opinion, the greatest track and field star. So Florence Griffith Joyner, when I was growing up, she was a wonderful, just great track and field star. And I remember when I was younger and watching the Olympics, they would say that she had an illness, but they were very vague about that. You know, so I just kind of want to mention or say, you know, she was someone who accomplished so much and, you know, had cavernous malformations. So I know sometimes when a person may get a diagnosis, there's not as much positivity. You know, I mean, you've just been told you have something that may or may not affect your life in tremendous ways, but just having the knowledge that you can overcome that, you know, I think that's very positive. And also looking at the time period, they didn't discuss things back then, you know, so it was just kind of, she had an illness and no one really knew about it. So you think it's important too, then, to recognize and encourage patients that, okay, you have this diagnosis, but it doesn't mean that you are the diagnosis.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a very important part of the healing process. When I woke up or out of surgery and found out what was going on, I had a lot of questions and really nowhere to go for answers. I had my colleagues who can provide me the medical aspect, the treatment aspect, the, you know, what are my options are, but no one that could tell me how it is to live with this disease process. How am I going to navigate the world? And that is where Breaking Barriers Initiative came into play. You know, I was Googling like basically support groups to find other people who were dealing with the recovery process. And it helped me out because I had a lot of questions post-surgery, post-bleed. You know, am I going to be able to work? Am I going to be able to provide for my family? Can I drive? You know, even what is sex going to be like? Will I be able to, you know, will my wife leave me? You know, there is many different questions, and being able to speak with other people with the disease process was comforting me, letting me know that, you know, I am not my disease. I am still a human. I am still Vegas Brown. I am still Dr. Vegas Brown. And speaking to professionals that see patients on a regular basis, that can help me, you know, recognize what, you know, what my symptoms or what subsequent symptoms could be, and where to go if I am having symptoms, what hospitals are the best hospitals to go to receive care. Because not all hospitals have the appropriate, you know, specialists to treat, you know, cavernomas in particular. And we're talking about cavernomas. So not every hospital may have a neurosurgeon. So you may want to go to a hospital where you have that access, or where that provider is there so that they can treat you.
And, you know, you've shared your experience as well. And, you know, you, like we were saying, you are not the disease. And so it's very encouraging to be hearing from someone who has the illness, and, you know, you are working, you are helping patients every day in a high pressure situation in the ER, in the emergency department. So it's just so encouraging as well to talk to you about it, and you can provide that insight. I know you probably don't see as many patients with CM coming into the ER, but I'm hoping patients or anyone who may be listening sees that as well or hears that.
Yeah, it definitely, I don't see any patients in the emergency department with CCM, but I do see patients that have, you know, stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke, which can, due to many different causes, but have the same presentation that I had. And, you know, a lot of times when I, you know, tell them or tell a, you know, a family member, like, hey, I had a stroke as well. I had a hemorrhagic stroke about 3 years ago. And, you know, the recovery, I am still in recovery, but the recovery was difficult, but it can be done. I'm blessed, to be honest with you. You know, right now, you know, I don't have any obvious deficits, but, you know, when I first had my bleed, you know, I had left-sided weakness. I had blurred vision. I couldn't really see. I had bad vertigo and, you know, and I had a lot of fatigue. But the recovery was hard, but, you know, I'm here now, and it can be done for anyone. And definitely when I tell them that, it definitely gives them hope that the same can happen for them as well.
I think that's the most important thing, that as patients, especially newly diagnosed, having that hope and having like a visual or a thought of, I can get past this, I will get past this. And even things now like Facebook can be a resource for, you know, going to support groups. You may not see them face to face, but you can share your experiences and they share their experiences. And you have that knowledge that you're not alone.
Yeah, Breaking Barriers Initiative has a Facebook group. And every now and then there is a message of encouragement that is received from the administrator of the group, or words of encouragement from different, I'm gonna call them, I say patients, but different people that, you know, are affected by cavernous malformation. So it's definitely encouraging when they put their story up, or, you know, and you hear from them.
I will try to find that Facebook page, and I'll go ahead and I'll link that too in the description for anyone who's looking for that. And, you know, you kind of touched on something too as well, not just patients. One of the things I hope to do as well with this podcast, just in general, is support those who are the family, the friends, the loved one of someone who's been diagnosed with an illness, especially a chronic illness. And it's going to be different for each patient as well as for different family members and loved ones. So, you know, I think having a page like Facebook where is it not only patients, there's other people on there who are kind of in the community, is it?
I think the majority of the people that are on the Facebook or the private group is our patients. But there are people that are a part of the Breaking Barriers initiative that give input. I don't think just anyone can join the group. It is a private group. So it's usually, you know, patients or people that were diagnosed with the disease process. But there are some people involved with the Alliance to Cure and Breaking Barriers initiative that give input or insight as well.
Okay. That sounds great because, you know, to have that resource there to be able to reach out. And I know nowadays a lot of people, they get information quicker or faster by using Facebook. It's kind of the go-to in a lot of things.
Yeah, there are a lot of different, you know, platforms that people utilize, but social media is definitely a big aspect or a big component of how people access and receive information.
Right. So, let's see, I do have a note here about like clinical trials. I know you mentioned research. Do you know of any clinical trials that are going on right now? Or is that included in the testing information?
I can't give you the specifics of what testing are being done, but AllianceToCure.org has a link on their site about the different treatment testing and diagnostic testing that and what phase of research is going on their website. But I don't have the actual name of the studies that are ongoing right now.
Okay. Well, the clinical trials are, you know, they're one of the initiatives too, as far as making sure there's full inclusivity with those clinical trials.
So yes, that's what one of the things that you know, Alliance to Cure and Breaking Barriers are attempting to do is make sure that there is inclusivity, especially among the African American population. I think they had a statistic that said that there should be about, you know, 20 something thousand patients identified with cavernoma in the African-American population, but I think they've only identified less than 100. The African-American community is definitely underrepresented in the different studies. And that has multiple reasons as to why that is. From a medical community, we don't do a lot of surveillance or we don't go looking for patients to include them in the studies. And then there is a lot of apprehension in the African-American community to be included in studies because of, you know, things that have happened in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, and that has an effect, a downstream effect that we don't know, you know, one, patients don't get identified and they don't receive the appropriate treatment. But subsequently, we don't know if, you know, certain treatments are beneficial to patients because they're not included in the initial studies. And there may be a genetic component or there may be, you know, some component that is not researched because of the lack of or not being involved in the initial trials.
And that's where hopefully Breaking Barriers can come in and hopefully be able to get more people who can participate in those trials. The figure you were talking about, the 20,000, you know, I think the comparison there was there were 80,000 white people identified, and just looking at that, those numbers compared to who was in clinical trials, there was that disparity there. And when I was talking about with Dr. Patel about the importance of clinical trials, we were talking, and I think you said genetically too, sometimes it's good to get information from the family members and testing done to try to help narrow down what may be causing the mutation or why some people may get it and some don't, even if they're in the same family, even siblings.
Yeah, it's important. I think, you know, it's important that you find out, yeah, like you say, the difference between, you know, siblings or difference between, you know, one population versus another. So it's important that we, you know, everybody's included. I think there was there's a statistic, or they say that, you know, African-American patients that do have cavernomas, they tend to have a higher degree of spinal lesions versus the brain lesions, and trying to determine why that is, you know, so that's important as well.
Yeah, so more to be preemptive or proactive as compared to reactive.
That is correct.
And what I was thinking of a moment ago was, I read that it wasn't until 1993 that the National Institute of Health started to really take steps in making sure that minorities and women were included in clinical trials. So that's 1993. That's not even 30 years ago, not to mention the time it took to implement those requirements and how those requirements would be met. So we're talking about after I was born, I was almost out of high school by this point. That's how close it is in time. So when you think about all the years and testing prior to that, that there were a high percentage of people who should have been represented in trials, even for cavernous malformations or any other rare disease, that weren't calculated. So a lot of the knowledge obtained up until the point where they started to implement that, it's important, but it's not complete. It's nowhere close to being complete. And so it's almost like playing catch up to get the data and information to address it through the whole community.
Yeah, it's we're definitely playing catch up. You know, unfortunately, the African-American, the community has been underrepresented in many different aspects. Females have been underrepresented in many different aspects. And hopefully we will continue to see improvement inclusion in those studies in different aspects of medicine altogether.
You know, was there anything else too that you wanted to go over, whether it's regarding cavernous malformations or anything else within healthcare?
No, I basically just want to recap and basically say that, you know, cavernous malformation, again, is a rare disorder, not easily recognized or not recognized a lot of times. Most people are, again, asymptomatic. When you have symptoms or if you're having symptoms that are concerning, I want to encourage patients to advocate for them, for themselves, or encourage their family members. If the family member is having, you know, signs and symptoms that are concerning to get the diagnostic studies that are necessary. And, you know, for cavernous malformation, that is typically an MRI, you know, and look for, you know, support groups if you are diagnosed with cavernous malformation or any other rare disorder. For me, that support group is Alliance to Cure and the Breaking Barriers Initiative. And if you are diagnosed with the disease, you can make recovery and lead a normal and fruitful life.
Okay, thank you. And like I said earlier, you know, to be speaking with you, and thank you for being open about your journey and what you've gone through. But for anybody listening who does have cavernous malformations, just because you have that diagnosis, you still have so much to offer. And so you know, I'm just finding it so encouraging talking to you and discussing your journey. You know, and I'm very happy to have you here speaking with me today. Well, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And like you said, we are human. We are still people. We are, you know, we are the same. We just, we have something that is a component of us. It is not us.
Yep. Perfect.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Once again, I'd like to thank Dr. Brown for speaking with me to help understand cavernous malformations, as well as the inequity that still exists in healthcare, and that there are so many strides that still need to be made in just various different areas of healthcare until we achieve true equity. It also helps to understand some factors that a person may not think of that actually do have an impact on access to healthcare or understanding the cause of an illness. So we should all be looking at healthcare needs, not only of ourselves, but for our fellow human being, as there's no particular mold for everyone, that everybody's situation is different in regards to whether it's an illness or what an individual's needs are in order to access the healthcare that will best treat their disease, not only just medicinally, but in all aspects that may affect healthcare. I will be linking some sources and resources in the description of the episode, so please go in and take a look at those to get a better understanding on the Breaking Barriers Initiative, as well as other information about cavernous malformation and trying to achieve equality in healthcare. Thank you all, and I hope everybody has a great week. And this should be released the week of Thanksgiving coming up. So I hope everybody has a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.